This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's not often that you get to ask a Supreme Court justice about how he arrives at his opinions, so I'm very pleased to have as my guest Justice Stephen Breyer. He's written a new book called Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. He says he wrote the book to increase the public's understanding of what the Supreme Court does. He explains how the court first decided it had the power to hold federal law unconstitutional, how the court managed to gain and hold the public's trust even when its decisions have been highly unpopular, and how, in Justice Breyer's view, the court should help make the Constitution work well for contemporary America. Justice Breyer was appointed by President Clinton in 1994. He's a former Harvard Law School professor. Justice Breyer, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to read about the court from the point of view of a Supreme Court justice. So thank you for writing the book. And let's start with your constitutional philosophy that the Constitution should be a living Constitution, that it needs to work for contemporary Americans. Whereas Justice Scalia in the court thinks that the Constitution should be read more literally and justices should keep in mind basically what the framers had in mind and only that. Would you describe what you see as the fundamental difference between the two points of view?
I can say what I think. I think that we're following an intention by people who wrote this document, Madison, Adams, Washington. I mean, the framers, Hamilton, they had an idea that they were writing a constitution. In that constitution, they would create certain institutions. The institutions were designed to create basically democratic systems of government of a certain sort, protecting basic liberty, as it turns out, assuring a degree of equality, separating powers, so state, federal, and three branches, so that no one has too much power, and assuring adherence to a rule of law. Now, those are very general statements, and much in the Constitution is written in a very general way. Words like freedom of speech do not define themselves, nor does the word liberty. And what they intended, I believe, with these very basic values in a document would last for hundreds of years. So they had values that changed but little, while the application of those values changes as circumstances change. They didn't foresee the internet. They didn't foresee automobiles or television or radio. And yet they wrote words that can apply to those changing circumstances.
If we interpreted the Constitution only literally in the way that the framers had in mind, would we still have slavery?
No, I'd not necessarily. We fought a war against that. And the Constitution didn't say you had to keep slavery. Rather, the framers tried to postpone the issue. They thought it would go away. They were wrong. It certainly didn't go away.
What do you mean they thought it would go away?
They thought eventually, or many of them thought, that eventually, perhaps in 50, 60, 70 years, the South would come to the realization that slavery didn't work and was an evil institution and would abolish it. And instead of that coming about, it seems from what I read, that things got worse and we ended up in a civil war. And there is a lesson in this for the court.
Which is?
The worst case ever decided, the Dred Scott case, where the Supreme Court said that a descendant of a slave was not a citizen or a person who could sue in the United States even if he became free. That was a terrible decision. And the only justification I've ever heard for it was that Roger Taney, the Chief Justice in the majority, thought by deciding that they would avoid the Civil War. It happened the opposite way. They fed the flames of a Civil War. Abraham Lincoln said he couldn't believe that decision. He called it an astonisher, a legal astonisher. And the lesson, in part, is that judges are not very good politicians. And if you want people to decide politically, you better let Congress decide, not the judges. We're in an institution that is not really to decide politically and is to be there in order to protect people who might be very unpopular.
Let's look at an example where you try to interpret the Constitution as a living Constitution, trying to figure out the values of the framers as opposed to a literal interpretation. And you ended up being in the minority decision on this one. And I'm thinking of the Second Amendment case in Washington, D.C., about a local law prohibiting handgun possession and whether that violated the Second Amendment or not. So what was your thinking in deciding that this law prohibiting handgun possession did not violate the Second Amendment? And let me just read the phrase here that we're considering, that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Yes, that's what it says. And parts of that, I use this as an illustration how I would say I very often and some others do approach difficult constitutional questions. And the first thing I think we'd want to know is what are the values, what's the basic objective of the Second Amendment? And their history is relevant. And some people thought, the majority thought, that a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, that that isn't the heart of the thing. The heart of the thing is the right of the people to keep and bear arms, and that means to protect themselves from attack even by burglars. The minority, of which I was one, look back over the same history, and they say, no, this was put here for a particular reason. What happened was that Madison and the others who wanted the Constitution faced opposition from states, and the states were afraid that Congress would call up state militias as part of the federal army and then disband them, and the states would not be protected. Don't worry, says Madison and Hamilton. We will write these words into the Constitution, and they will protect the state's right to have a militia. Now, the minority thought that was the basic value underlying these words. So there was a disagreement. Now, if in fact you accept the minority view, look back at the words, look back at the language, look back at the history, this does not have much to do with keeping a pistol on a table to protect yourself from a burglar. Now, the second half is assume the majority was right, which I did not assume they were right. I don't believe they were right, but I'll assume it for argument's sake. Still, on the assumption that they're right, and this has something to do with keeping pistols next to your bedside, the question is, what does it have to do with it? The District of Columbia had passed a law which said that you cannot have pistols in the District of Columbia. And the question would be, is that law prohibited by the Second Amendment as the majority interprets it? And I thought, and the others in dissent thought, the answer is that the District of Columbia can pass such a law because it serves a very important objective, saving lives from burglars, from accidents, from suicide. And it is overwhelmingly important. But you see, what we're trying to do there is to work out, is this kind of prohibition that the District of Columbia has proportionate? Is it fair? Is it reasonable in light of the ends, the objectives, the values in the Constitution?
So when the justices were having a spirited debate about this handgun decision, did you ever think that you would actually change anybody's mind except perhaps a swing voter like Justice Kennedy? Did you ever think there was any chance on the face of the earth that you would change Justice Scalia's mind on this?
I might. I see how you're thinking, and this is probably because this is your job, and the press's job is to take those decisions that are the usually have very great visibility because they're political, so they're in the newspaper. But you should remember, first of all, that probably 30 to 40% of our decisions are unanimous. That the 5-4s account for maybe 20-25%, and it isn't always the same 5 and the same 4. And so we discuss, and it isn't always a sure thing.
In terms of your ability to change other justices' minds, particularly the mind of Justice Scalia, when it comes to a decision like handguns, I think a lot of Americans, a lot of court watchers, court reporters see this court as a court with a block of activist conservative judges who are very strongly conservative and are very consciously trying to move the court and the country in a more conservative direction. And I'm wondering from your seat on the bench if you would agree with that perception.
I'd say this about the perception. Put it in context. Put the perception in a context where you're probably talking about a very small number of cases, maybe 10 cases out of 80 or 90 during a year. Then put it in a context where people, in trying to change other people's minds, all know that the other people want to change their minds. And the way to change somebody's mind is to make certain your own mind is open and that you have a genuine discussion. Not in every case can you possibly have such a conversation because there might be, you're too distant, there might not be a point. And then remember to put in context when you use the word political. Of course, it's understandable that the press in writing about the court and the political scientists in describing the court want to describe this in ordinary political terms. But one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is I wanted people to put that phrase in context. In the sense of pure politics, I don't politics. I worked in the staff of the Senate. I know some pretty good politicians. And that isn't what a judge is. And that isn't what we do. Now, you say, well, what about ideology? I'll say, ideology, pure ideology. Are you an Adam Smith free enterpriser or a Maoist, Marxist troublemaker or something? That kind of thing doesn't influence it much. But a person's basic values over time, of course people develop approaches as to how legal questions could be solved better.
I think the I think the perception
Sorry.
Is that presidents, particularly some presidents, appoint judges because of their politics, because they're conservative or because they're liberal.
Teddy Roosevelt appointed Oliver Wendell Holmes, and within 3 months, I think, Oliver Wendell Holmes had decided away a very important case, antitrust case, contrary to the way Roosevelt thought. He was in dissent in the Northern Securities case, and Teddy Roosevelt said, I could carve a judge with more backbone out of a banana. He was pretty annoyed. So if presidents think they're going to get the decisions that favor them out of judges, well, sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. But if what the president is trying to do is to appoint someone who, in law, has a general view of the country and how law relates to people and what it's about that is closer to his own, a president will be more successful, perhaps not completely successful always. Now, that means that judges over time, there will be a diversity of views on those very basic jurisprudential or philosophical points in the court. This country is a country of 300 million people or more, and people think very different things. And it isn't a bad thing that quite different basic approaches are represented on that court. And I keep that in mind in those instances where I'm so certainly certain I'm right.
My guest is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. His new book is called Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Breyer, Justice Stephen Breyer, and he's written a new book called Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. One of the things you write about in the book is the question of when the Supreme Court was established, would people follow the court's decisions? And, you write about a decision with Andrew Jackson as president where he didn't follow the court's decision. And then you write about President Eisenhower, who sent in troops to uphold the court's decision in Brown versus Board of Education when the South wasn't desegregating schools, as they were told to by the Supreme Court. In the Bush v. Gore decision, which you write about, and you were in the minority on that, you thought that the court shouldn't have heard the case, and if they did hear the case, they should have decided differently. You point out that Al Gore went along with the decision. Did you ever think, after Bush v. Gore, that Al Gore wouldn't go along with the decision or that the decision would be so unpopular that there would be massive demonstrations or rioting in the streets?
No, I didn't think that. And I don't think many people did. And what we show in this first part, is not just a given, but it reflects a lot of history, and it's a positive direction. That wasn't true, as you pointed out, in the Cherokee Indian case. It required the 101st Airborne in the case involving segregation in Little Rock. And it was more or less taken for granted, I've heard people say, including the Senator Reid. One of the most remarkable things about the case is something that isn't often remarked, and it's just what you said. It's that people did not turn to guns or battles in the street. They more or less accepted decisions they thought were wrong, and I agree with them it was wrong. But I think it's a treasure that we do accept the decisions of the institution.
When you accept a decision like that, that you really think is wrong and that, you know, had a profound effect on the country, can you just kind of like let it go and move on to the next decision, or does it eat at you and upset you?
It upsets me. It upsets me. But I know that tomorrow is another day and we'll have other decisions.
So let me ask you about another decision. One of the things you write about in your book is how the court tries to uphold previous court decisions, but sometimes a court decision really needs to be overturned. An example being Plessy versus Ferguson, which said they're separate but equal is okay. And then it took Brown versus Board of Education to say, no, separate but equal isn't okay, and schools had to be desegregated. So you were recently weighing in on a Supreme Court decision that kind of overturned previous court decisions, and I'm thinking about the Citizens United case, which gave corporations the right to give unlimited funding to candidates because to restrict the funding would violate the corporation's right to free speech. And a lot of critics of this decision said, well, you're basically giving a corporation the right of a human being to free speech, and a corporation isn't a human being. So what decisions do you think that decision overturned?
Well, there were a number. They're listed. John Stevens wrote a long dissent, and the four dissenters agreed with that dissent. And he found instances going back many decades where he thought that the power of the state to regulate the contribution of a corporation or a labor union was pretty well established.
So what was the argument within the court, if you could give it, between overturning these decisions and not? Because one of the paradoxes that I think a lot of court watchers saw in this decision was that judges who oppose, quote, judicial activism ended up overturning precedents.
The people who were for it thought that the deviation from prior precedent was not great and that the Constitution, at the heart of it, did permit the corporations to give the money to further speech, political speech. The persons against it thought the contrary. I can't easily summarize the opinion, and I'm reluctant to, because what's written is what's there. And it's best to let other people do the summaries, and it's best to encourage people to read what they want to read there. The power of the opinion is important. That's where we put down our reasons. That's where we support our reasons. That's where we can be criticized. I think most judges will go into a job like mine, and they'll think some decisions should be overruled. As you said, Plessy versus Ferguson had produced a country that was divided and segregated by race, contrary to what the 14th Amendment assures. And that had become apparent by the time of Brown, that it was contrary. It did not produce an equal protection of the law. So the decision was overruled, and I think most of us would say correctly so. But that doesn't mean you can overrule every decision with great ease, because that way lies chaos. So one of the more difficult things for judges to decide is when you overrule decisions. And there are helps in the standards that have been laid down for that. But ultimately, you have a need for stability and not overruling that must be respected. And sometimes you think it's necessary in order to get to a truer meaning of the Constitution to overrule the past.
Have you ever decided to overrule a decision?
I'm sure that I have. And
If you could think of an example, I would just like to.
Yes, I can.
Great, because I'd love to
the
hear
one that I was
how
on the
you
side,
weighed
the one that
it.
I,
yeah.
The one that I was on the side was the Bowers v. Hardwick, which talked about the right of the state to forbid homosexual conduct. And that was later overruled by the court, and I joined the decision overruling that earlier decision. And there were a set of reasons there, which included the fact that this law was rarely enforced, that it allowed the police to enter the bedroom, that there was no specific harm being done, and that the court the first time deciding the case, decided not too much previously, had made, in the majority's view, a number of serious errors that meant less protection for a group of people who were going to have this law enforced, perhaps arbitrarily against them.
My guest, Justice Stephen Breyer, will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's written a new book called Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. He served on the court since 1994, when he was appointed by President Clinton. The Florida preacher who threatened to burn the Koran, some people said, well, that's his free speech right. And then, but what about the rights of Muslims who would be offended to the core, outraged by that act? As a Supreme Court justice, I wonder how you looked at, if you're willing to talk about it, how you looked at that event. And if there's the possibility that burning a sacred text of any religion would be considered a hate crime. Like, how do you balance all of the rights and positions involved in a situation like that?
Well, I don't look at those things, that issues and so forth, that might come up in the future. Because if they do come up in the future, I'll have the issue in front of me, and it will be very, very well briefed. There'll be lots written about it, and I'll be able to form a more intelligent opinion. I would say that where you're talking about the freedom of speech, and something like this preacher or anything like that, I would keep two cases in mind. One is years ago, Justice Holmes said, you cannot shout fire in a crowded theater because that could kill people. Very well. That sets limits to the freedom of speech. But the court also said, where an American flag is being burned in protest, that the Constitution protects that. Because it is a purely symbolic action, which is being done, despite how much people hate it, to express a point of view. So, we probably, were we to have such a case, we'd have to have a law in front of us, see what it says, see what the actions are. But I've given you an outline which sort of sets boundaries.
You've been in the Supreme Court since 1994. What are some of the ways you've seen the court change since then?
Well, it's gotten a little harder for me in some respects. First few years, I'm pretty nervous about whether I can do this job. Then you adjust to it. And I think that over time, I worked pretty well with some of the members there. And I was quite often in the majority. And then Justice White said years ago that with every new member, it's a new court. And we've had a number of new members, and the court's changed, and people learn to work with each other again. And there we are. I'm more in the dissent now, if you want a more precise statement. That's it.
And what's the difference between being in the dissent and being in the majority when you come to work every day?
Like, I prefer to be in the majority.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's not quite as nice to be in the dissent. For one thing, people pay less attention, and you have the law going the way that you think is wrong.
How would you compare the Roberts Court versus the Rehnquist Court?
Well, from the personal point of view, you've said it. The Roberts Court is one where, so far, I've found myself more in dissent. If you want a characterization in terms of conservative and liberal, but that's not my job. That's your job. That's the job of the press and the public to characterize. My job is to decide the cases, write the decisions as best I can.
I guess I was wondering if you think Chief Justice Roberts is different as a Chief Justice than Chief Justice Rehnquist was.
Every new appointment is different. Every new person who comes on makes it a different court. So the difference is not just the individual, it's the reactions of the others to that person. White said that some time ago, and I have found truer words were never spoken.
But do they run the court differently to the extent that the Chief Justice runs the court?
No, the Chief Justice is in charge of administration. But each of us has a vote, and each of us votes on everything. And the one power that the more senior members have, and the senior justice is the most senior, the Chief Justice, is that in those cases if the Chief Justice is in the majority, he will say who writes the opinion in the case. But there are constraints. We all write the same number approximately of cases over the year. Quite often, the assigning who's going to assign the case, it sort of answers itself that question. It's fairly obvious from what people say in the conference. So there is some additional authority there, but not additional voting authority.
You know, when I interviewed Jeffrey Toobin, the legal correspondent for CNN and The New Yorker, and this interview was not too long ago, I was shortly before Justice Stevens retired. Toobin said something that really just astonished me, which is that sometimes in courting a swing voter, they will be told that they can write the opinion if they're in the majority. And that's a kind of little carrot that can be presented to the swing voter as incentive to vote with the team that wants to be the majority.
I wouldn't that's true, but I don't put it in that way. Look, put yourself in the courtroom in our conference. There is an issue. It's either A or B. The first four people say A. The second four people say B. And there I am, the most junior member. I say, I don't know. Who will you assign that opinion to? You have to assign it to me.
Why?
Because your job as chief, if you're the, your job is to get a majority for a position. The job of the court is to decide. You have to decide it to assign it to me because I'm uncertain. And however I go, so will go the court. So I'm the only one that will produce a majority. Since the others are certain and I am not certain and it's 4-4, the mechanics of the court require it to be assigned to me.
But is that political?
You tell me how
is that political getting you to do it as an incentive? No,
it's nothing to do with an incentive. It is to do with what the court is supposed to do, which is the court is supposed to decide cases. That's our job. And we decide one case after another. Now, how can you get a decision of a court in that circumstance without assigning the case to me? Because I will be the one who determines whether it's A or whether it's B. Now, that circumstance does not arise often, but sometimes it does. So I learned from that if I don't want to write the decision in such a case, I better say I'm pretty sure.
Were you in that position of being uncertain?
Sure.
And then you ended
I have
up having to write the opinion?
I have been. That has been the situation in some instances. Occasionally that's happened. That happens with everyone. And that's why I say sometimes the assignment decision, it decides itself.
So how – I don't know if you could give us an example of this, but in a situation where you were uncertain, how did you make up your mind?
I've been uncertain in that sense fairly. It's not totally rare. I just had a case where I really thought that I was going to join this particular person's opinion. I really thought that was the better opinion. But I thought before I make my mind up definitely, it wasn't one I was writing in, before I make up my mind definitely, I want to sit down and review them. And I went down, sat down, reviewed the opinions, and then thought about it for a while and said, I can't join that other one. Not that it's wrong, but it's more consistent with what I've generally been thinking and really have thought generally to join the other opinion. So I joined the other opinion, having thought that first I wouldn't. And that's what Sandra O'Connor means when she says that when you're there for a while, you create footsteps. That is, you take approaches, and there's a need to be consistent with what you've said before. You don't want judges who feel they're jumping from one thing to another in terms of their general philosophy or outlook. So what you do is sit down, think about it, and then you reach a decision. I'll tell you something interesting about that, too, if you want.
Sure.
Human nature.
Yeah.
I've found it interesting. I bet it's true whether you're in business, whether you're in law, whatever field of life you're in. You have a tough decision to make, really tough. And you think, my goodness, this is evenly balanced. Oh, my goodness, what will I do? But I'm sorry, time is passing. You better make up your mind. And so you do, and you think this side has a slight edge. Now time passes. Do you think, I might have been wrong? No, as time passes, you begin to think, I think I was probably right. More time? Yeah, I was right. More time? I sure was right. More time? How did I think the opposite? That is called the self-protective psychology of human nature.
That's been your experience on the court?
By and large.
No regrets. But have there been decisions where you really lost sleep in trying to figure out which side you were on?
Yes, I would say. It's an uncomfortable feeling. It's a kind of void before you begin to make up your mind, and before you and it happens a lot. It's not that you don't have a point of view. You know, you read the first brief, and there's the question. You say, "I bet I know how that comes out." But then you read the next brief, and you think, "Oh my God, no, it comes out the other way." And then you go back to some of the reply briefs and say, oh. And then in the oral argument, you can go back and forth. That doesn't mean you don't have a point of view. And it doesn't mean that you're not open-minded. Open-minded is you may well have a point of view, but you're open to changing it. And I've discovered that quite a lot. It isn't really a void. It's that you're not quite easy so far with your decision. It's like that old joke about the judge. Says to the he hears the plaintiff and says, "You're right, you're absolutely right." The defendant says, "Judge, you haven't heard me." He says, "Okay, what do you have to say?" Listen, says, "You're right, you're absolutely right." And the plaintiff says, "Hey, judge, I mean, you said I was right, now you say he was right. We can't both be right." And the judge says, "You're right, you're absolutely right." More like that than you think.
So the outsider perspective is that all arguments now in the court are pitched to Justice Kennedy because he's perceived as the swing vote.
You're probably thinking of some cases, which is going to be a minority out of the 80. And you're probably thinking that you can read what he's thinking. I've learned over time I can't necessarily read what the others are thinking. I find out best when I'm talking to them in the conference. Then I'll know.
You were the junior member of the Supreme Court for many years, and now there are you are not.
That's true.
And there's two very new members now, Elena Kagan and Justice Sotomayor. So does that change your experience a lot, not being the junior member?
No. The junior member opens the door in the conference when somebody knocks. And they usually have some papers that somebody forgot. So the junior member hands them the papers. Sometimes you might hand somebody a cup of coffee. I handed Justice Scalia a cup of coffee. He said, "You've been doing this for a long time." I did. I did it for 11 years. I said, "Yes, and I've gotten very good at it." And he said, "No, you haven't." there we are. That's the junior member is not a significant matter.
And in terms of how
sort of fun.
of how you think and your position as a leader in arguments?
The argument isn't just simply the argument and discussion. It may be sometimes an advantage to go first earlier in the discussion because then people listen to you and their minds are less made up. But it also can be an advantage to go last because then you've heard what other people say and what you say can be affected by what they say. So sometimes it works out one way, sometimes it works out the other.
Well, Justice Breyer, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Justice Stephen Breyer has written a new book called Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Ricky Skaggs has been playing the mandolin professionally since the age of 6, when he performed on stage with Bill Monroe. He became a mainstream country music star in the 1980s. In recent years, Skaggs has been performing in a more traditional bluegrass style, sometimes with a gospel influence. The latest result of this is Mosaic, a pop gospel bluegrass collection. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Carved my name upon a tree, a knife into the bark, trying to make a mark so they remember me. Wanting to matter to someone, maybe be a reason why, be the apple of an eye before my life is done. Saying I'm in a place where all I'm praying I'll see my face in your mosaic, and I am a piece in the deal, and it is real.
From the opening verses of Mosaic, it's clear that Ricky Skaggs is fine-tuning his music, shifting his sound slightly. Skaggs is singing about his Christian faith in strong yet delicate tones. But the tunes aren't the rigorous bluegrass ones we've come to expect. Instead, he's trying out variations on pop melodies, and he frequently sets his mandolin aside so that his plaintive declarations can be heard with greater starkness. On My Cup Runneth Over, it's Peter Frampton who provides the guitar hook.
You ask, is it half empty? You ask, is it half full? You've seen that on a t-shirt, and you've heard that line in school. Well, it's really very clever. Let's don't play by those rules. If I give a different answer, would you think of me a fool? It's none of the above.
Skaggs has spent most of his career either writing his own material or covering traditional bluegrass, country, and gospel music. On Mosaic, however, Skaggs has a new source of material, one that provides a different sensibility for this project. Every song was written or co-written by Gordon Kennedy, who's also written songs for Eric Clapton, Garth Brooks, Bonnie Raitt, and many others. Working with Kennedy's material, Skaggs is singing with a new alacrity. The material risks melodrama, but at its best, singer and song achieve the power of forthright modesty.
When I was brought to judgment, 'twas nothing I could say, and guilty was the verdict. Still I am walking free today, and I am the chief of sinners. Should have been left for dead. My
Something in the chemistry that occurs in mixing Gordon Kennedy's melodies, the Christian imagery of the lyrics, and the surging vocals results in music that is both vivid and thoughtful. Skaggs has said in a couple of interviews that he hears Kennedy's songs and their mutual arrangements of them as having a Beatles feel. That may be an ideal in his own mind, but it suggests what a break with his past he considers this material. To my ears, the songs frequently capture the artistic paradox of good gospel music, expressing humble piety through bold, passionate performances. On this song, I'm Awake Now, Skaggs is joined by his daughter, Molly Skaggs, for a lovely, irresistible collaboration. You don't have to have a shred of religious belief to be charmed by the combination of Molly's voice and her father's mandolin.
I'm awake now, no mistake now. I'm awake. It's okay now, I'm safe now. I'm awake, I'm awake now. For those of you who think I'm sleeping, as you stand beside the bed, for those of you who may be weeping, don't look for me among the dead. I'm awake now.
If the Gordon Kennedy songs that fill out Mosaic have given Ricky Skaggs a fresh sound, Gordon Kennedy's tunes certainly benefit from being performed by Skaggs. The singing frequently redeems a treacly turn of phrase or a maudlin melody. The pieces don't just fit together on Mosaic. They lock into place with a firmness, an inevitability, that sounds as though chance or faith or fate have little to do with it. I prefer another, even simpler term, art.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Ricky Skaggs' new album, Mosaic. You can hear three tracks on our website, freshair.npr.org. Over the last 30 years, China has undergone the hugest modernization in history, going from essentially a third-world country with a billion people to having the second-largest economy in the world. The statistics about China's growth are so staggering that it's easy to ignore how such a transformation has changed the lives of hundreds of millions of people. That change is the subject of a prize-winning new documentary, Last Train Home, which has begun rolling out in theaters across the U.S. Our critic-at-large John Power says that it's a superb portrait of individuals trying to figure out their place in a nation that's changing at lightning speed.
Back in the 1980s, the culture critic Marshall Berman wrote a brilliant book called All That Is Solid Melts Into Air. He argued that the great drama of modernity is the way that people go from being passive objects of modernization, mere tools of history, to subjects who struggle to define their own relationship to a world in which everything is changing. Never has such change happened on a greater scale than in modern China. The different ways individuals deal with this is the subject of Last Train Home, a gorgeous new documentary by Lee Sin Phan, a Chinese filmmaker based in Montreal. Shot over 3 years, Last Train Home deals with an amazing social fact. Every single Chinese New Year, 130 million migrant workers leave the cities and return home to their rural villages. The movie puts a human face on this migration by showing its effects on a single family. Su Qin and her husband, Chung Hua, originally come from a remote village in Sichuan province. But for the last 17 years, they've been living in the megacity of Guangzhou, where they sleep in barracks, slave away in a garment factory, and give their savings to their family back home. When we first meet them, they're about to make the 2-day trip home to their village to see their two children, their sullen 17-year-old daughter, Qin, and her younger brother, Yang, who, by law, aren't allowed to live with them in the city. Su Qin and Chung Hua are stoked, and we anticipate a happy reunion. But when they arrive, dispensing toys and cell phones, we discover that things are not as we expected. Su Qin and Chung Hua see themselves as doing what it takes to brighten their kids' future, and they're upset that Yang's class rank has dropped from number 3 to number 5. In contrast, their children view them as bossy absentees who care more about making money than looking after them, and things only go downhill from there. Not that Last Train Home is grim or doleful. Phan shot the movie himself, and his images are absolutely ravishing. And he's put the story together with the help of Mary Steven, an editor best known for her work with Eric Rohmer, who has a novelistic eye for detail. Together, they've achieved that rarest of beasts, a documentary that's lively as well as deep, that's heartbreaking, yet doesn't wallow in depression. Structured around three annual journeys home, the movie tells a story at once epic and intimate. The epic side comes out in the second year, when Su Qin and Chung Hua spend days caught in a train station queue so vast and devouring that you almost long for the calm of a soccer mob. These crowds remind us that the family we're watching is only one of tens of millions like it. You see, modernity is roaring along like a runaway train in China. In fact, things are happening so fast that from one generation to next, people have wildly different ways of being modern. Eager to escape the millennial drudgery of subsistence farming, Su Qin and Cheng Hua embraced the new economic freedoms. They moved to the city to give themselves and their family a better life. And they feel that they have. But because they were raised in the austere values of a Maoist peasantry, they do all this in the spirit of stoic self-sacrifice. It's impossible not to be touched by both their self-denial and by their sadness that their children don't seem to be honoring their part of the bargain. But their kids were born into a later hyper-capitalist China, and we don't really blame them for having their own ideas of how to be modern. They don't want to be A students like their parents expect, don't want to spend their lives sacrificing themselves in the name of the future. Qin, in particular, can't wait to abandon school, get out of the boondocks, and move to the city where, surrounded by high-rises and neon and the intoxicating whir of the now, a girl can have some fun. Although we fear that Qin will be a lamb to the slaughter, Last Train Home is no morality tale. Fan realizes that he's chronicling a transformation so vast that there are no easy conclusions about how people should live. He knows that once the genie of modernity has been let out of the bottle, individuals are left to ride the whirlwind of history. They have to make it all up as they go along.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Last Train Home. You can see clips from it on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.